accessibility to transport, encouraging the use of public transport, and then cycle parking and storage, the introduction of new cycle hangers, and its future rollout. So I'd like to call upon Councillor Rose, first of all, and then I'll invite Councillor Burgess to speak. So, Councillor Rose, would you like to just address the committee, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee, for inviting me once again to join you this evening. Thank you for the list in terms of the issues you'd wish to discuss. I'm fairly relaxed about the order and sequencing of it. I've got information and updates. In terms of the first item, I know I'd been back on two occasions to cover LTNs and the street space reviews as they were at that stage. I wondered if the committee wanted to pick up where we left off, or whether the information provided previously about the timetable was sufficient. Further to add to that, the Dulwich scheme has concluded its decision-making process and been made permanent. The Walworth one is in the latter stages, and that's been communicated to residents in the coming week or two. And then the sequencing around the slightly smaller schemes on Great Suffolk Street, Bermondsey Street, Faraday, Brunswick Park, North Peckham Rye East, Little Cycle Lane, will all be subject to the same process and will be concluded over coming weeks. And that process is clearly set out and replicated across all schemes in relation to notifications, information to residents, and the necessary traffic orders and the statutory consultation process throughout. So I'm very happy to pick up any further questions on that from the committee this evening. In relation to air quality, in terms of sort of lead items before we go into the substantive discussion about it, just to update and make the committee aware that our current air quality management strategy sort of comes to the end of its natural life cycle by the end of 2022, and we have an obligation to ensure that we have a new strategy in place from 2023. We've already commenced a member officer sort of framework to begin stakeholder engagement prior to public consultation processes that will take place towards the latter half of 2022, and that is working towards having a new AQAP in place for 2023 through to 2027. General comments around that process, I would reflect that the way in which we talk and discuss air quality has changed remarkably since the strategy was first written, and that we've got to ensure that we come up with a strategic framework and a way of consulting and engaging with people that is meaningful and fit for purpose in terms of the space around air quality. And the aspiration and the things that we've been working towards in recent years is expanding the monitoring network of the air quality management area. We're looking to ensure that the whole borough is covered by and included within the air quality management area. That correlates with the decision on the ULEX extension to the South Circular. We want to take, the air quality management area all the way through to the tip of the borough. In terms of air quality audits on schools, we've achieved 55% of those. We want to expedite and increase that going forward. Anti-idling enforcement strategies commenced. We're supporting the GLA wider air quality agenda. Working with them, we're waiting to see how the Mayor and the GLA respond to the ambitions of the World Health Organization targets around air quality and emission levels. They're working more with around the low emission network, and how we integrate and ensure that the issue of air quality and exposure to air quality is dealt with and relayed and conveyed and understood by people in relation to any other further low traffic intervention measures. The work we want to do around improving the quality of our own vehicle fleet is there within the forward plan. There are ambitions around that going forward. And in terms of the progress we've made, there's been a 22% reduction in NO2 emissions in the borough since 2016, but there's clearly a lot more work to do, and the distinction and nuance around different types of emissions and our understanding around that. In terms of parks and green spaces and biodiversity, again, the headlines is that we have maintained an incredible track record within Southwark. We're a joint third place in terms of the external Good Parks for London rating. We've maintained 30 green flags, and we are joint third in the UK for the number of green flags that we have. We are definitely on target to exceed our planting target of 10,000 new trees by the end of March, April. We have seen a large volume of tree works over the last 2 years, nearly 20,000 tasks and jobs completed. Biodiversity has been impacted in terms of volunteer engagement throughout the pandemic, but we had over 262 volunteer days hosted so far this year, and that we've had 31 biodiversity events again throughout the pandemic, and we've done a range of interventions and engagement online, and we've had over 4,000 people engaged on the issue in the year, which is a remarkable achievement given the circumstances, and there's lots more around biodiversity that we can talk about. In terms of public transport, we are in a situation where we still have yet to know if we have a funding settlement for London, and the implications directly for our borough is that our funding bid for our LIP programme, which is the borough-specific element of the Mayor's Transport Strategy, is still unresolved. It's been deferred again this week until Friday. We might not get the full amount of money we bid for. We might get notification of how much money we will get much later in the year. And this has all a level of risk and consequence for us as a borough. During the pandemic, we're aware that patronage on public transport, the demand and revenue of the TfL has been reduced, and the concentration around the impact of the pandemic in relation to central and inner London has resulted in fewer commuter trips in and within the core of the city or central business districts, if you like, and we've seen changes in patterns locally further out in the borough. So fundamentally we're facing a situation that the best case scenario is that we're looking at a level of reduction in the amount of bus services, 4% reduction in the amount of kilometres operated by the bus network by 2024-25. So we know that the Mayor has indicated there will be two key consultations during the summer, both in terms of realignment of bus services, that will take place late spring, early summer, and also work around potential options for road user charging throughout London. In terms of public transport more generally, our transport policy team will continue to work with Network Rail and Trail operating companies to increase and improve access to services, but obviously the direct consequence of the impact of reductions to TfL's funding in relation to secondary access at some of our key stations. But we have seen some good work, especially around Denmark Hill, about improved access and further police access to that station. But there's a lot more to do, and it's a real concern that some of those projects that we thought were in the pipeline and about to be delivered look very precarious, especially in relation to Peckham Rye Station, step-free access, and ensuring that the money we've already invested in relation to the Elephant and Castle and the tube line investment around there has a real and meaningful return for local residents. And we're constantly reviewing the provision and uptake of cycle parking at stations, and it's clearly something that we're very keen to develop in terms of that interchanges of seeing active travel, walking and cycling to access other forms of transport, be it bus or train, is fundamental going forward. I'll pause there, but we can pick up in relation to cycle parking and storage more specifically, and then I can also give you far more detail on parks and biodiversity and green open spaces in the borough. And I'm delighted that in person we have quite remarkably Tara Quinn with us this evening, and it's fair to say that the parks team have been working solidly throughout the weekend, and we've got around 66 live active sites or areas where were inspected and still working to resolve the implications of UNIS and are actually Franklin today, actually. So it's a live situation.
Thank you, Kathleen. And yes, welcome, Tara. And I forgot to say also we have the head of highways on the Zoom as well, Dale Foden. You there, Dale?
You said he was able to stay until 8.
Oh, there he is. Yes, he's alive and well.
Thank you. Yeah, very good.
Yes, excellent. Sorry?
Yeah, no, just to thank, take the opportunity to thank both Dale and Tara for the sterling work that Highways and Parks have done over the past sort of 2 to 3 days. The ability to respond to the situation in a very calm, measured way, and to prioritise the areas in which we get the teams out to remove trees across the carriageway or areas where people are at risk is really commendable. Yet another added aspect of 2022 on top of two very difficult years.
Indeed, we'll all agree with that. Thank you very much. Now I'll bring Councillor Burgess in at this point, please, if you're ready there, Radha. Thank you.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Ian. Thank you to the committee. I hope everyone got the paper that I circulated earlier on some of the ambitions around the Streets for People work and how we would like to locate our interventions very much in a framework of social justice and the ways in which we can do that. And really it's a kind of pitch to say that what we need are a holistic set of interventions that need to work together in order to satisfy our goals of increasing active travel, of tackling air pollution, which Catherine has spoken about just now, and to do it in a very effective way and an equitable way, because I think there's been a recognition through a lot of the webinar series that we did and through contact with constituents and other groups that there's no single solution to tackling all of these things, and in particular different areas will need a different set of interventions, because no area is the same as another, and whether it's the topology of the area or the makeup of the communities there, that will demand a different kind of set of interventions in order to be most successful. So the paper is really essentially a group effort that is based on feedback from colleagues, from constituents, from affected groups, and in part some of the feedback we had from a major piece of consultation work that was done in the south of the borough. And I'm very happy to talk about any of the elements in the paper that you've seen. So over to you.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Councillor Burgess. Okay, I've got four members that have already indicated they wish to ask questions. The first is Councillor Newings, please.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know, I had a couple of questions on two different topics. One is on parks and one is on the low traffic interventions. Can I take those two together, Chair? Would that be okay?
Please.
Thanks. So, with regards to the low traffic interventions, it may be appropriate to address these questions either to Councillor Rose or to Dale Foden. When we last had the Pleasure of Your Company in this forum, Catherine, I raised concerns with you over specifically over Croxted Road, and also there are very specific concerns, as you are aware locally, about traffic on East Sellish Grove. I am aware, obviously, of the and been involved in the discussions that we've had with TfL, which has now said that TfL are going to make some interventions with traffic light signalling in Herne Hill, which ought to help alleviate those problems on, if not completely solve them, on Croxted Road. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about those areas in particular. And on the parks side, I was going to ask as well, so this is not so much for Dale, but specifically here for Catherine. Again, I'm not sort of, this possibly doesn't fall entirely into your remit, but I am very conscious, as I think sort of, you know, many members will be, that there is a certain narrative which seems to be emerging in social media, shall we say, and other public places, that somehow Southwark Council is going around happily building on its parks and green spaces. Now, I know as a reserve and planning committee, I sat on an application recently where, as planning committee, we turned down an application to build something which was not even on the park, but quite close to Burgess Park. I wondered if you could explain sort of whether there is any truth at all in the suggestion that we are building on our parks and green spaces, and actually sort of clarify where we stand on that issue and exactly what we are doing. Thank you.
Do you want to deal with that now?
Yeah. Going back to the point around the low traffic neighbourhoods, and you cite the two locations of Croxteth Road and East Dulwich Grove. I know that both Margie and Richard, and also James, Charlie, and Victoria in particular, have been incredibly strong advocates in relation to working with the community around those two sites. I think we're often criticised wrongly, in my mind, for not imparting information that is perceived as being trying to mask something that isn't occurring. If I'm not making much sense, but I just wanted to point that we have committed working with residents and local groups to ensure that we maintain and monitor and understand the traffic patterns as they develop over time in relation to both those two locations. And a lot of work has been done with residents to understand the data. And I think we're in, especially in relation to Croxteth Road, we're in a much stronger position, but still with a fair challenge around the issue of congestion, about recognising the significance of working with Lambeth and TfL, and that ability of TfL to have strategic oversight around the junctions and light signalling that they maintain and operate. And again, it's really commendable to both the two local ward councillors and to Helen Hayes, the work that we've done with TfL around the importance of area-based planning. And I think that's a key principle that TfL have accepted and understand now in relation to the wider Herne Hill area. And it's something that we continue to work with our colleagues in Lambeth and any other borough that we're working on interventions that share a boundary and a boundary road. And I think that's been a really positive, albeit challenging, experience. So you will also know that the changes to the time restrictions came into effect on the 17th of February, and again, as a result of the sterling work of the councillors and others, we have been able to expedite the timetable for TfL to do the work on the signal junctions and the lights. So there's more to do, and we recognise that, we want to continue to work in a more constructive way with the residents at both East Dulwich Grove and Croxteth Road on that. And we've always made clear and reporting about the level of congestion at those points, and that's the challenge going forward. We're there to reduce traffic levels overall in the wider area, and we're there to understand the modal shift around active travel and other interventions in and around those areas that are worked through, what further improvements we can do in relation to bus travel times, bus journey times, and the reduction in the amount of vehicles driving through that area. So it's an ongoing process, and we've put additional monitoring locations in all of those locations, and we continue to have a really comprehensive level of monitoring, and we're working towards a much clearer, immediate dashboard of presenting that information to residents going forward. So there's on that point, and then in relation to the strategic point that you make about parks, and you allude, Councillor Newings, to the interplay between the planning process and the guardianship of parks and green spaces. So I oversee or work with teams that manage over 106 sites, 5 major parks, 33 local parks, 16 gardens and squares, 2 sports grounds, 3 cemeteries, 5 playgrounds, and 42 other open spaces. No one's building housing on those locations. To say so is wrong. The planning process has really stringent safeguards, and in policy terms, the only construction in relation to a site of MOL or the designation in regards to the sphere of parks and open space would be ancillary sports and education use. And there are occasions where there's been benefit and enhancements to facilities and access to MOL and other open space as a result of that. But So as a borough, we've had a population that has reached its peak of 500,000 sort of in the 19th century, early 20th century, and that's dipped and we're back up to around 300,000 as a population. When this borough was first formed in 1965, we had around about 350 acres of green space and parks. We've got now got over 410, and that's going to increase. I think what we've looked at, the tension is around people's protection of the open space where they live, and again, the park service is there because we maintain and help maintain with groups those spaces to ensure that when proposals come forward, they go through the planning process, and that is the rigour and scrutiny that any application deserves to have. And if anything, development on council sites and council estates is held to a really clear high standard in terms of design aspect, in terms of space, in terms of the provision of amenity and space. So we should focus our attention on third-party applications where they seek to develop new places to live, where they don't put the biodiversity in, they don't create the space and amenity for all age groups, and they don't create the open space that they must. That's where we should focus our attention.
I think you'd be able to get a job as a tour guide. Anyway, thanks for all that knowledge and information. I've got Councillor Ali next.
Hi, Chair, I've got two questions on two different topics and probably two follow-up for at least one.
Oh, sorry, before I bring you in, I forgot. Dale, did you want to add anything to what Catherine just said? Or?
No, I think it was quite adequately covered by Councillor. I was obviously, if there are any additional questions, fine, but no, I think it was covered more than adequately.
Excellent. I'm glad you said that. Thank you very much. So you want to ask two questions on
question each on different topics.
Okay.
And then maybe a follow-up, if that's okay.
Okay. Just, okay. Right, fire away.
So the first one is on cemeteries. And speaking over the last few years with the Muslim community about burial spaces, I know there's a wider issue about there just isn't enough. But many Muslims end up having to be burying their family members outside of the borough. I'd previously asked Richard Livingston when he held the portfolio, and he said the demand wasn't there, but I think it's kind of almost like a cyclical thing. If you can't find a space here, then you'll go somewhere else. So the question is are we thinking about actually catering? 8.5% of our population is Muslim, if not greater now. So there's a question about, are we going to be doing something to make sure that Muslims, who are very much part of this community, will see their life through in Southwark and end here in Southwark, rather than having to end somewhere else that they've got no relationship with and nor that their families are, is one question. And then coming back to a point that you raised in your initial brief around meaningful consultation. So that the conversation around LTNs have been hugely divisive. And I just wanted to hear a bit more about what is meant, what are your plans for meaningful consultation, both not just around roadblocks and LTNs, but the wider sort of place shaping. And I appreciate climate emergency isn't necessarily your portfolio, but it's still part and parcel of all these. So it'd be good to hear those, please.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. In terms of the cemeteries at this point, and there's an awful lot of work done in relation to the changing needs of all our communities in relation to their want to commemorate and memorialise the passing of loved ones and relatives, family and friends. And I completely take your point around ensuring that we have a wide enough provision to allow Muslim residents to have that choice within borough, but there are ways in which we want to sort of synthetically engage around that and understand the needs and requirements in terms of timescales and the religious sort of requirements to ensure that they get the burial in the time that is prescribed and understood in the manner and conducted in a sensitive way. So there are ways in which we're looking at the moment to offer a wider range of memorialisation and options for all forms of burial, which we hope will allow those sections of the community that want issue and not to feel like on passing that they feel isolated with a place of rest, so that they continue to be part of a community. So there's more work going on that. I mean, I think the impact of the pandemic over the past 2 years has meant that focus has been on accommodating that, but we've learned an awful lot around the needs of the various communities that have faced that in an accelerated way, sadly, and we'll take those learning points from there and continue to develop it. So I don't have a more specific answer than that, other than a statement of intent and sensitivity to the points you raise and a commitment to sort of follow that up and make sure it's adequately reflected, because we will need to come back and revisit the issue of the long-term burial requirements of our population and options. And for other sections of the community, the option for an out-of-borough burial in a different location may well have an appeal, or if we can come up with other forms of interment for and commemorating people, and that too can often meet people's needs and then get a fair understanding of what we do with the space in Borough going forward. But it's a point well made, so thank you for bringing that up.
Can I just add, Catherine, when I was the relevant cabinet member back in 2017-18, we had a plan for that. Unfortunately, it was resisted and opposed by Lewis Schaefer and company, but there we are. We can't win everything.
It's a very sensitive issue. We've got to have in terms of the meaningful consultation, you're quite right. And over the 10 schemes, we sort of consulted and engaged or had responses from best part of 12,000 people, sitting from the biggest exercise we've done as a borough, overshadowing everything else. And I think one of the key points going forward is the importance to communicate with people, a really clear starting point to the process, because we implemented change during a pandemic at speed, and an inability to consult just wasn't there in a traditional or known sense. And it's something we wouldn't seek to repeat in that regard. I think understanding the sense of place and context and the points that Rod has raised already is really important. Being clear with people about what we know about data in relation to the problem we're trying to solve, and getting that sort of understood in terms of what is the issue we're trying to resolve in the context of this location in relation to traffic, cars, other forms of transport. And then working with clear set parameters about the regular provision of information and data going forward, and agreeing and knowing and understanding what improvement and success will look like, but also recognising that may well prove to be a challenge for certain sections of the community. And so we do a consultation and we listen to it and have regard to it, and I'm often accused of ignoring a binary vote on something that didn't really exist. It was quite an extensive consultation process to elicit people's experience and what they felt were the priorities for them, and they were all very different. And I think what we do as councillors, what I do as a strategic decision maker, is have regards and understand what they are being told, and I think we've made significant changes where issues have been highlighted. But also recognise the strategic decisions that I have to make for the whole borough, a population, the majority of which don't own a car, and the majority of which would seek more choice and alternatives around the way in which they travel, especially for short journeys. And we end up with a consultation process, which understandably is often dominated by car owners of a certain age. And that's important, because they are a sizeable part of our population. But there's a wider regard I have to have of that choice, reduction in emissions, and where we all want to get to. And I think where there is an awful lot of consensus in terms of the end point, and that's the challenge.
Thank you, Catherine. Did you have a follow-up just there?
Yeah, thank you very much for that. So if you go, there's a website called carbon.place. I don't know if you've had a good look at that. And I made this point in a previous council assembly, but when we talk about consultation, I appreciate you focused your answer mainly around LTNs, but in the wider conversation about climate and separately air pollution and separately neighbourhood place shaping, the wider process, the feedback that I've had from residents is that it just felt like it happened too late. And more importantly, it was more of a, we're asking your opinion, give me your opinion, okay, and then I'm walking away. And the point that mentioned earlier, be part of a more co-design exercise. And so if I go on to Carbon Dot Place and look at Councillor Newen's ward, Dulwich Village, and it's got you know, an incredibly high negative impacts on from a climate perspective, actually cars and driving is a very small part of that. A far larger part of that is around energy, such as gas and electricity, and also the behaviours of people, so consumption of goods and services and flights. So, and I appreciate it's not quite your portfolio, but in the work that you're doing, will you be considering actually how you stimulate behaviour change rather than necessarily sort of looking at things as a roadblock in the street to do a few different things, perhaps?
I think you make a pertinent point, and the job now is to create those structures, both constitutionally and in policy terms, that align those things. So, for instance, we have got the Air Quality Action Plan strategy that we have to review because it's come to the end of its life cycle. We've also done a report, an interim report on the movement plan with a view to getting that fully revised from 2023 as well. So, you know, a critical thing is that the movement plan and all the disciplines and requirements within that, in terms of policy context, in terms of delivering what we have to do in a statutory sense, but much wider than that, about our ambition for the borough, aligned with the climate emergency declaration and the action plan around that. Now, best place to be aligned with a really clear air quality management strategy for the whole borough. So when we go to talk to people and place make, we are able to clearly and concisely communicate the sum total of what we're trying to do. So a lot of the conversations around low traffic interventions, be it a streetscape scheme or anything else, is around a response to being prevented from doing something that I usually do and inhibited, and rather than this could enable me, this could enable older residents, this could enable school children to travel more safely and reduce the toxicity and improve the air quality of where they live. So I think that's a really key learning point around all those things that you mentioned and how we convey that, and that's really the challenge going forward. But as they say, structurally now, I'm really keen to ensure that those things are aligned, and that we talk in the round in a really clear and plain English and direct way, and that when we go to talk to communities, we have the data and the information to be able to convey to them, we know and understand where you live and what your problems are. And that's the challenge going forward. And I want people to understand the contribution we've all got to make, and the behaviour change that we've all got to help facilitate over time. We can't sustain an ever-growing number of cars. It's going to get more expensive for people to drive full stop in terms of purchasing fuel, switching to a low emission or electric vehicle, road charging. It's going to, in many respects, those people on the lowest incomes that have a small car to make their life work, going to be most impacted. Those that are able to afford very expensive cars or very expensive electric cars and other ways in which they can displace their impact on the environment will be impacted less. And my priority is to support the former rather than the latter.
Okay. I've got Councillor Burgess wants to come in.
Yeah, sorry, I was just unmuting. I just wanted to echo one point that Catherine was making around the importance of clear communications, and I would add to that just the transparency around data and making sure that the data is in fact comprehensive enough that people can have confidence in it. And one thing I think is particularly important is that because climate change is so serious, and if we're going to make claims about tackling, you know, positively tackling climate change through certain interventions, what we need to provide people with is a kind of climate change calculation. So we need to be able to sort of confidently say to residents, yes, we are sure that the increase in journey miles that an LTN can sometimes create, an increase in miles and emissions, is sufficiently offset by either traffic evaporation or modal shift. So I think that, you know, if people, you know, there are lots of people making lots of claims about climate change, but if we were to provide a robust calculation that was, you know, properly derived and evidence, I think that would help us a lot, actually. Thanks.
Thank you. I've got Councillor Buck next, please.
Thank you, Chair. Catherine, I've got two kind of more, well, one kind of strategic question and one more specific, although also slightly strategic question. And then, Chair, if it's all right, I've got a short one for Radha as well. Is that okay?
Fantastic. Yep.
So, Catherine, you were talking kind of at the start of your piece about some of the more strategic public transport issues. And one thing which got me really excited that I'd seen recently was that the mayor was thinking really seriously about road pricing, and that the potential of road pricing particularly had the opportunity for us to avoid both cuts to TfL and kind of support for infrastructure projects and the things that, that we wanted to see. So could you maybe talk to us a little bit about where that conversation's gone? Because in the mayor's TfL budget for this year, it looks like the price is going up, services going down. And that is a concern when we have a major issue of commuter traffic and the need for more public transport infrastructure and services. So could you maybe tell us where that conversation is and what the conversation the administration is having with the TfL around that? I understand there are some strategic issues, but it does seem like a priority for us. And the second thing you mentioned very briefly about Elephant and Castle, as a Walworth councillor, I would be derided if I didn't ask what the situation with the tube station funding is, given the priority for us to expand the public transport infrastructure there. If I wait for Catherine to come back, and then I've just got a small one for Adam. Okay, thanks.
Working backwards, we have sought and received assurances as best we can have for the situation in relation to ensuring that the investment we've already made in relation to the signal box within the other castle and other related ancillary works is there, and it's very high up in terms of priorities within TfL, and we've got assurances on that. The next question is, as the network as is, and subject to the settlement, the risk is that the investment we've made doesn't get realised in relation to an expansion and growth of the network in relation to the Bakenham Line extension. But it's in place and it's funded in order to make that happen in terms of the importance of the Elephant and Castle as a station and the interchange, and in terms of supporting and facilitating an extension at a future point. So that's reassuring, but it's not, there's still a confidence point around it to continue to work with TfL on. But we've invested a lot, committed a lot already around the growth that we've already seen in the borough, and that will continue. And we're very hopeful, or we insistent, or we will persist to ensure that the growth that is promised and needed is not lost any longer than it has to be in relation to the current situation. But that's only something that the Department for Transport can resolve by making that commitment. Working with TfL and the mayor rather than against them, and to give a fair settlement that will not only support London's growth but also the nation's growth and confidence. And it would be a retrograde step not to give us the settlement that London so desperately needs. In relation to what was the other point you made about fares, wasn't it? And I think it makes quite stark and sober reading the options that the mayor's tabled in response to Transport for London, the Department for Transport's position. But that's the reality of it. And as I alluded to, the impact on bus routes and kilometres provided, and the starting point and terminus of key bus routes that so many of our residents depend on, is something that we've got to be really mindful on. So in parallel to the road charger pricing consultation in late spring, early summer, we've also got in parallel the bus realignment. I think in terms of the road charger pricing, I think the mayor has set out sort of a range of around four key options. ranging from a charge of £2 a day to drive within a defined area all the way through to something more nuanced and targeting types and size of vehicle. But there's a complexity to that that we'd wait to see more information on in relation to the borough impact. And the ULEX extension about the type of vehicles that are coming into the borough, we've only had very sort of macro information about that. Sort of London-wide, South Circular, North Circular data. What we're really keen to see is the borough is something more specific in relation to our area. We have information where we've got parking restrictions and a permitted scheme. We're able to get some really good information about the types of cars that residents own within Southwark. So around 79% of vehicles of that type are ULEZ compliant, around 8 are hybrid and 1% are electric. So I think that's all part of further bits of work going forward in relation to car ownership, parking and wider enforcement regimes in the future. But the sooner we see that information and understand the impact of the ULEZ extension, what that might mean for road user charging more widely in London, the better position we'll be to understand how we work as best we can with it and how that can support the transatlantic travel in the borough. But yes, watch this space really is the short reply to your question, Jack.
Thanks. All I would say, Catherine, is when we're thinking about the opportunities for road pricing, not just to affect modal shift, but also on TfL's finances, a simpler scheme that can be brought in quicker is better in terms of the public investment that we need in public services. So, I mean, that would be my only comment, and I would hope that that's what the administration is lobbying for. Brada, one very specific question for you, and then I will stop hogging the mic, specifically in the Streets for People paper, something that we've spoken about in the past, so this won't be new to you, was the idea that I had about cycle loans for council tenants. And I didn't see it in the paper, so it was a very specific ask of what's happened to that, has it gone anywhere, is it something we're considering, because we know obviously that modal shift for working class tenants, the price of bikes is a huge issue, and I thought that could be a potential solution. So have we looked into that, where has it gone?
Yeah, so Jack, of course I still agree with you, and I think that there is I don't know why it's quite not in this paper, it was certainly in another paper, but there's obviously a huge amount of work, a sort of discrete piece of work that needs to be done on our estates, you know, first of all with looking at the provision of cycle storage, cycle hangers. We need to be, I think, much more joined up in terms of making sure that there are really good walking routes through estates, so that estates are really kind of exemplar places for active travel, and that we need to enable all of that. When we were doing our rounds recently on the manifesto, and I'm sure you fed back a lot of stuff into that process, but one of the things I brought up to Kieran directly was, you know, what about this 0% loan idea, you know, for people? And he said, I think those things already exist. So he was sort of saying, I think they're there already, probably no need to put it in there, but I will follow up with him and find out. But I was banging the drum all the way for you on that.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear.
So we've got a number of supportive cycle schemes and operators within the borough, so run away from, I think, Pedal My Wheels is the try before you buy scheme that is principle, and it is something we're actively looking at across both individual residents' needs and facilitating bike exchanges and the creation of other ways in which you can get access to a bike if you need it for all ages, especially younger people. So we're actively looking at that, and again the movement plan development and our aspirations going forward certainly put facilitating cycling and access to a bike and safe storage is fundamental to that.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Let's move on to Councillor Linford Hall, please.
Thank you, Chair. If I may, I have two questions for Councillor Rose and one for For Councillor Rose, in last summer public consultation, the majority of people said that they thought the traffic schemes were not achieving their aims. And 64% of people living in the working in Dulwich who took part of the consultation said they wanted the junction to return to its original state. Why did not take full consideration of the results of the survey of a good all councillors living zones commitment? That's the first question. And the second question is, Helen Hayes MP, in a letter to many of her Dulwich constituents in December 2021, said the council was never going to return the junction to this original estate. Is that true?
Well, in, I think I've talked about the complexities of a very comprehensive consultation process and mentioned the significant amount of changes and revisions that we've done in terms of listening to the many and varied reasons why people responded to the survey on in relation to all our schemes, including Dulwich. We've got some of the most generous and clear exemption policies of any London borough in response to the concerns around blue badge holders and other vulnerable drivers and people dependent on the car that we support. Similarly, in terms of access for emergency vehicles, so I would suggest that that reflection on whether the only solution is to return to the original state is not really the response. A certain section of the community were seeking that, but I made a balanced decision on the benefits that we've gained. So the significance of the junction is it's in the way in which it acts as a hub for a series of other routes and measures where we've seen an incredible increase in cycling and footfall. And in many respects, the success and which is on that safe route that we have created, and if I don't use that junction to reset road prioritisation going through Dulwich, tell me where else do I put it to achieve the same results. It's central in terms of a hub, it's safe, and actually to counter the point that nothing's been changed, it's wrong in the sense of we have made revisions to it in response to access. We have worked with the community on that and the emergency services in particular on that, and there is going to be a co-design process about the permanent improvements to the public realm at that junction and that location, and that's all been committed to in response to the feedback that we got. It became, I suspect, a disproportionately focused aspect of a much wider scheme that delivered a whole range of benefits to a much wider section of the broader community in South London and the wider Dulwich area. I understand people's frustration, those that wanted to see that return to the original state, but given what we've learned around the future of active travel, around the pressures around emissions, around road use, around car ownership, I would ascertain that the biggest learning point from all of these schemes is that we could not return to the original state. It's not an adequate response to the challenges we face. There was another point that you raised around the letter, which I think is a quote that doesn't reflect the wider context of the response, and I think my answer sort of addresses that point as well in relation to those points that have been made, but thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Have we got one for Councillor Rogers?
Yes, please. Yes, far away.
Councillor Rogers, how did Sada Council assess and what is the evidence on LTNs are having an impact on climate change?
Sorry, Mary, I'm so sorry. My son just came down and opened the biscuit tin. Could you repeat that?
Talking to the mic a bit more.
How did Southwark Council assess and what is the evidence that LTNs are having an impact on climate change?
Well, at the risk, thanks for the question, Maria. There's no biscuits being opened now. I think that is a really, really excellent question. I might hand over to Dale for an answer about the precise calculation. I think it's really important to get into the weeds on what's actually happening. So I'm sure we've all read our Cairns Goodwin document on the great discovery about reducing demand for driving, which was done in 1988 or something. We know that although traffic evaporation can occur at a kind of median rate of about 11%, typically in the something like 75 schemes that we looked at, what also happens in 84% of cases is that traffic increases on alternative routes. So bearing that in mind, what we need to understand is, as I mentioned earlier, is what is happening to actual journey miles in the area. Are they increasing? Because essentially, if you reduce road capacity, then people naturally have to go further. What impact does that have on emissions? And what impact does that have on climate change? And the thing that is really interesting to look at is, to what extent are journeys evaporating, so people are deciding not to get in a car, or people are deciding to get on a bus, which we shouldn't forget is also a very, very key element of active travel. To what extent are journeys evaporating, to what extent are they going on to different modes, so the bus or cycling or walking, whatever else. And so with all that information, we can actually come, I think, to a climate change calculation so that both we and the public actually can have confidence that these schemes are actually helping us tackle climate change and not exacerbating it. And I think that is terrifically important, and that work should be done forthwith, really, because otherwise it's hard to make those claims without that kind of robust and transparent data. We also have we have lots of data points as well. So we have the automated traffic counts that you'll see those cords that are placed on the street. So they gave us a rough idea of what's happening with traffic on the streets, how many vehicles are going past, etc. We also have really brilliant things like vivacity monitors in different places in the borough. There's one in my ward on Southampton Way, and that very accurately can give us a picture of LGVs, HGVs, cyclists, pedestrians, cars, etc. But we also have access to something called Waze for Cities, and that is something that public authorities can access to really get a very, very good picture of changes in congestion, which is super important. So sometimes we unintentionally conflate traffic and congestion, and we shouldn't do that because they're very different things. So you can have a situation where it looks like the numbers of cars passing a point have gone down. You might say, well, traffic's down, but actually what's happening is congestion is simply increasing. So we can, we almost need a kind of data person just to crunch all of these details. But it is incredibly important to get a grip on journey kilometres, the congestion point I've just made, traffic count, and some kind of idea of emissions. And of course, it's really important to understand that different vehicles, like HGVs, will have far greater, far worse emissions smaller cars, etc. We have a wealth of data. As with everything, somebody needs to crunch it, and someone needs to crunch it in a way that can give us confidence that we're doing the right thing, and can give the public confidence that we're doing the right thing. I hope that answers your question, Maria.
Yep, it does. Thank you very much. I've got Councillor Edwards next, please.
Thanks, Chair.
actually. I've just been starting with reflection really on the, what we've heard about LTNs, and then I've got a question about step-free access, so that's okay. Just with the questions we've had from Councillor Lynn Fulford and Councillor Ali, your kind of impression being given is there some sort of hostility or suspicion or even opposition to LTNs from the Liberal Democrats, but their 2019 parliamentary manifesto, in which Councillor Ali stood, stated that they would legislate the right to unpolluted air and take action to reduce pollution, especially from traffic. And one wonders how they intended to do that without the use of schemes such as LTNs. So, you know, it seems to me like they need to kind of get their messages in order on that particular point. My question was on step-free access to stations. It's a massive issue in my ward, particularly with Nunhead Station. And it seems to me that the council and other bodies are quite good at working together, or at least talking to each other, when there's a radical change happening in a particular area, like when we've got big redevelopments or big regeneration projects, but less good when we can't, not huge amounts happening in a particular area. And so Nunhead Station has been crying out for step-free access that would change the lives of local people for many, many years now. And yet it never seems to be kind of seriously on the agenda in terms of that high level of investment that's needed. So my question is, what can we do to get Network Rail working with us more positively on places that perhaps don't always get as much attention as where the big development projects are happening, so that we can get that kind of project off the ground and move it?
Yeah, so I completely agree with you, and and the point you make is really, really valid, and especially in a borough like ours. Once we've got 10 stations, and once you get, you know, Peckham Rise the Third and Canada Water and London Bridge at the top, and then Peckham and then Denmark Hill, and Peckham is the busiest station in London without step-free access, and it's just, you know, a travesty that it's not. And then you get stations that serve an ever-increasing level of demand in Nunhead and Queen's Road that deserve and warrant step-free access. Why we wouldn't want all our stations to be step-free access, I've no idea. I think the key to getting leverage is to spend time to work out approaches to stations in the wider context to help facilitate. And the things we can do are investing in infrastructure on the highways and carriageways that we manage and control in and around the station approach, and demonstrate a clear sort of strategy and master plan for how that supports wider objectives of active travel, to support rail use, to support busing changes to stations, and to continue to make that case. And I know within these organisations' models, the ability to make that investment, quantify it, and then put to them that there is match funding in the context of improvements that they should be delivering, and that we, if enabled that situation, so we are working in synergy with them, and that the latter bit of the puzzle, the piece of the puzzle, is for their works on the station infrastructure that they manage and control. So I think it's that clear purpose about having a mini master plan around station approaches, how the station has a relationship to the wider sort of traffic and street infrastructure around it, and just really clearly presenting that to Network Rail and showing willingness that, you know, working with them, getting that access, improving ridership, improving passenger numbers, we'll see the return, and it's an investment, not a liability, to invest in those stations, and that's what we need to get to in that sort of in the round. So I'm really keen to ensure that we do more of that work as a borough, and we present that to Network Rail, station and rail operators and line operators in that way.
Thank you. I've got Councillor Chamberlain next, please.
Thank you, Chair. I've got two questions for Catherine. I did have one for Dale, it's a very specific technical question.
Yeah, he left a message in the chat just to say that if there are any specific questions like that, then...
maybe I could ask Catherine that.
And he'll provide a written response.
It's about crossings. So my first question was about our relationship with TfL. So there's been quite a lot of chat this evening about manifestos. Actually, another manifesto that we could look at is the Labour manifesto from 2018, where it says that, you know, Labour's going to campaign for three new tube stations on the Old Kent Road. It's going to campaign for a work with the Mayor of London for a pedestrian and cycle bridge at Canada Water. It's going to campaign to reinstate the RV1 bus service. These are just some examples of how TfL has not served Southwark over the last few years. How do you feel, you know, you mentioned tonight that bus services are going to be cut even further in the next few years by TfL. So I'm interested in how you'd rate our relationship with TfL and whether or not we actually are ever listened to by the Mayor and by TfL. Because it doesn't feel like they are, or maybe you're just very bad at campaigning as a Labour Party here in Southwark. And actually,
That's why we don't win.
A specific question about how you are working with TfL. This is a serious point, actually. You know, Southwark has the 13th worst air pollution in the whole country, and that's particularly bad in lots of schools around lots of schools, and a lot of those schools are near TfL routes. So, what specifically are you doing to work with TfL on improving air quality on routes that they are responsible for? Like Borough High Street in my ward, where it's four times the limit that's acceptable by the World Health Organization.
Well, I would go direct the Victor to the movement plan document that went through Cabinet, Apologies Committee, which gives a praise of the work over the past 2 years and a snapshot of what we have delivered and achieved. And if you look at that, you will see that there is a very constructive, healthy relationship with the TfL, contrary to points you've made, in terms of what we have done in 2 years and previously. Under the situation of the pandemic, with 10 street space schemes and delivering directly TfL's priorities around active travel, the rollout of extensions to the cycle hire scheme, both docked and dockless, that was recently announced and confirmed for Bermondsey Borough and Bankside, the confidence that TfL have in us as a borough to ensure that the end of the Ride London international cycling event comes across Tower Bridge and into Southwark, because they have complete confidence around our commitment to cycling and active travel and working with us as a borough to deliver and promote the benefits not only to our own citizens and residents but the wider population of the UK. Ride London as a set piece international event, how that plays into our heritage as an area known for cycling, be it a BMX track or the Herne Hill Velodrome. TfL have confidence in us to work with us on Elephant and Castle and station improvements. They know that we support investment in the tube network with the commitments we've secured around Canada Water and growth areas around there. They know and understand the case we made for the Bakerloo Line extension. They have a team in place, and because of the lack of settlement, that's the thing that's impacted on the ability to progress that at the speed, not the campaign case that we made. We continue to make the case around areas such as Camberwell, and looking to sort of support a refresh of the business case around Camberwell and those other stations that Councillor Edwards made reference to that are really important going forward as part of the wider piece, and how TfL can put the infrastructure to connect people to it. Confidence around the e-scooter pilot that we did with TfL. There's that work on sort of crossings, the commitment we've got to make our roads safer, 20 mile an hour borough now, the work we've done to demonstrate how we can support the roads that we manage to make them safer, so as bus routes pass through the roads that we manage and go on to key bus lanes and prioritisation, and we're working towards the delivery of 24/7 bus lane prioritisation and talking to TfL about that. That's all about their confidence in us. So I would counter the point you make and said, despite the actions of the government, despite the incredible pressures that TfL have faced and despite the challenges of the future, TfL have got an enormous amount of confidence in us, and we're working with them and making the case for area-based planning. We're working with them to demonstrate what we're doing to help them deliver and support active travel as that key priority, and what we can do to increase bus and rail ridership and support TfL to get people confident again, to get journey times down, to get the reliability improved, and to ensure that together with TfL we create a fit for purpose transport network for all our residents. So I would say, despite all those things, we've done an incredible amount, and that's a testament to the success of our relationship with TfL.
And specifically around, I asked about what you're doing on specifically what you were doing around air pollution on TfL routes.
Yeah, so we've got, as I say, the air quality management strategy is our borough response to the wider GLA London strategy. We don't do air quality management in isolation. There are a whole range of reasons in relation to weather, pressure, factors, generation of pollutants in the air that would be not within our borough but impacting on residents. The emissions from vehicles is the most sort of direct area of most discussion and concern, because it is the most tangible to most people's lives in terms of, especially because of the route to school. But we are doing work around ensuring the delivery of school streets that we did, and we exceeded the targets that we were set prior to the pandemic around the number of permanent school streets. We went from temporary interventions straight to permanent embedding of school streets. Around a total of 39 schools either had a permanent intervention and or a scheme that we are maintaining as part of that commitment. We're working with schools to ensure that we get all schools in a meaningful period of time to have and benefit from interventions to improve air quality on the journey to school and also the air within school. So since those targets were set around improving air quality in schools, we now know from COVID that ventilation and filtering of air within classrooms is also critically important. So we want to come up with a strategy that combines air quality and improvements to the point of the school and then into the school itself, for it to be purposeful and meaningful to some schools. And to ensure that when they get to school, children are working in a clean and high quality environment. So there's an awful lot that we're doing, both through the education department, both through highways, both through volunteer groups and advocacy groups and school communities, to ensure that all schools will get meaningful interventions, that we plant more trees and greenery, that we look at carbon sequestration around schools, green screens, and other interventions where the whole school community knows and understands why we're making changes in and around the school, and it's seen as a benefit rather than a restriction to parents on getting their children to school, and then the quality of the air within that school is improved. So I think there's an awful lot that we have done, but you're right, that we want to increase that further, but I think we've made a really good starting point on there, and then we can, be quite rightly proud of the work we've done around schools and air quality on routes to schools.
Councillor Burgess wants to come in. Councillor, we'd love to come in.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to make a brief point. I mean, I think it would be quite helpful to for the next administration to really drill down on where actually we see the major problems in the borough in terms of harm and which roads experience it. And it's very clear that main roads are the ones where pollution is absolutely greatest, often at two or three times the legal limits for air quality. It's where most accidents happen, so the greatest number of people who are killed or seriously injured. Southwark has a very interesting distinction of having one in five primary schools on a red route, and that is very, very different from boroughs like Waltham Forest that hardly have any schools on a red route. So our response has to be really, really tailored to the fact that we know where the danger is, we know where people are experiencing harm, and therefore I would just urge the new administration and this committee to have a focus on that harm and to tackling that harm as a priority, rather than hoping that putting all the eggs in the side street basket will help out main roads eventually. Because what those people are experiencing, the absolutely evidenced harm from air pollution are experiencing often gets worse when there's traffic displacement onto main roads. So I really would urge this committee to think about that, to think about pollution, to think about the harm that it causes, not only to physical health, but also to mental health. And when we talk about schools and we talk about air quality, that there is actually a focus on the place where the harm is greatest. And there is a strong correlation in terms of school populations between children on preschool meals and more ethnically diverse communities. Those are the children attending schools on main roads where the pollution is worse. So I really, really would just like that to be noted, and for the committee to urge some action and some intelligence on that very, very difficult and pressing problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Rhoda. Yeah, back to you.
Thank you. Catherine, I want to ask you about trees and tree planting. So between 2010 and 2020, Council actually ended up cutting down 2,500 more trees than it planted. And obviously a lot of those trees were well established, they were mature. You know, actually they were the sort of trees that we need if we're going to have that meaningful impact on taking in carbon and making sure that our borough is able to sort of be more greener and more sustainable. So I appreciate, you know, we have planted a lot more in the last few years, but they're saplings that are less, that contribute less at the moment to our tackling our climate emergency. So do you have any statistics, or can you provide them on the environmental impact on cutting down those trees over the last decade? And specifically, what are we doing as a local authority to protect mature trees going forward?
As a general point, isn't it, about we inherited as an administration what has been clearly historic underinvestment in the tree service, resulting in a situation where we did an audit and recognised that we had about 30,000 extra trees that we didn't realise we were responsible for, and we have now, if you like, that starting point of 82,000 trees, which is a significant number. And I think when you allude to the fact that we cut down more trees, I think there was a lot of work around recognising trees that were either diseased, unsafe or at risk. But we all lament the loss of a mature tree, and we don't set out to do that for any other purpose than to address those clear priorities and requirements. And we're in a position now, after a lot of hard work, to be in a real clear net gain in terms of an ever-increasing number of trees in a borough, and that again is a testament to the hard work of tree service, the work we've done on the realignment of the tree service, the maintenance of a good in-house team, working with partners, be they third-party volunteer groups or annual contractors, to specialise in ensuring that we continue to meet that aspiration about future tree planting is a really important one. We're now planting more heavy standard trees than ever before, so we have something like over near 1,600 heavy standards were planted in quarter four of 2021. 8,000 trees and whips were planted, and you allude to say that they don't have a benefit, but actually carbon sinking in certain parts of the borough for carbon sequestration is really important. So when you make a blanket assertion around planting more trees, actually when you look at the location of an urban environment where we should put more trees on streets, tends to be in the centre and the north of the borough. In the south, the contribution that can make in terms of carbon sinking, hedgerows, I think going forward is to have really strong ambition about the number of trees and mature trees and carbon sinks we create through hedgerow planting and saplings, but also to look at the quality of the tree canopy. So we have a tree canopy coverage of around 19% at the moment. As an Inner London borough, we want to grow that to around 24% canopy cover in a number of into the short to medium term, and that would see an increase of 24% in the total tree canopy as it is at the moment. So that's the next sort of evolving set of challenges for us as a borough in relation to trees. And then also, I've talked in terms of trees that we directly manage and control. There are, you know, a significant amount of trees that we can influence with our soft power through biodiversity gain, talking to third party groups, developers, and those creating public realm and places to live, where we can get a really high quality and biodiverse tree canopy coverage in partnership with them. So we've done a lot. We are really proud of what we've done, and we are coming up to achieving the 10,000th tree ahead of schedule and as promised, and we are likely to exceed that by the end of the financial year, which again the team are really proud of. But we have further ambition, and we want to continue at the scale and pace of that ambition that we've done in specifically in the past 2 years. I think we're also working towards looking at a green infrastructure strategy. I don't think we need to make a strategic case out of a consultation on why trees are important. I think we need to now talk to areas and local populations and communities about what that means for them in the context of where they live, be it a very urban environment that doesn't have any trees on the street, and the cooling and beneficial effects of tree canopy and mature trees would have for them, versus an area in the south where it's already greener, but there's opportunity through the open land to sort of do that carbon sinking down there. So that's what we'll be looking at next.
Thank you.
And then just finally, the highest question that I wanted to ask was, I've been campaigning for Southwark to have the first Progress Pride crossing in the whole of the UK. And actually, I think maybe it might not be now, because I think we may have missed the boat. But it would still be fantastic for us to celebrate our queer communities here in the borough. The technical advice I've had back from officers is that we can't introduce these crossings anymore because it's not, there's concerns about whether or not they're accessible. Clearly that seems I'd question that judgment given that, you know, the first Pride crossing is nearly in our borough, you know, in the very far south. You know, we have these NHS signs all over the place which are multicoloured. We've got artworks on Southwark Street. So maybe I can ask you, will you support my campaign to have to get a Progress Pride crossing here in Southwark? And will you help us do it?
No, I am hugely supportive of the point you made. Yeah, I think the officers, it's not reticence to do it because there's an awful amount of empathy and sympathy for it. The factors will be whether it's on a bit of land that we might manage and are responsible for, and often tree junctions aren't ours directly. And then there is an appreciation of the visual impact it might have in terms of road safety, and an assessment in an individual location is made, and how that correlates with whether it's a light signal or whether it's a different type of crossing. But fundamentally, I think there is more scope to be a bit more imaginative around having safe crossings in locations and queer spaces that operate safely for the people using them all the time, to the night and day, and looking to see if there isn't some sort of supportive or ancillary paint treatment that will frame it in that way so we can accommodate that. So I would look at it in that context. So wherever you've got the public realm and you've got a walking or travelling route, and it helps denote that you're entering into a queer safe space, and that you've got, you know, and I think that's important. So I think we just need to sort of look at individual locations with an open mind, but accommodating quite rightly statutory, legal and safety requirements around the safe functioning of road crossings. But let's work together on that and let's see what we can come up with.
Thank you. Awesome suggestion.
Okay, thanks. Councillor Burgess wants to come in.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to leap in there. Obviously, it would be lovely to have bright things everywhere. But I think that the issue with crossings is that they are extremely confusing for guide dogs for the blind, and indeed horses, police horses, because they can't read them properly. And they, and particularly with the dogs, they can lead their owners into very unsafe traffic situations. So I think there was a problem with that in a different bit of London, but I think that was the rationale, just to give some clarity about that.
Okay, we'll do our homework. Councillor King, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try and do that. I've got three questions, which I'm happy with very short answers because I'm conscious how long you've both been talking. I think I've spoken to both of you about the concept of what I badly term as LTM jealousy, but feedback from communities that they would like to see the same, or not necessarily the same, but similar levels of investment in their local areas. And I was just wondering if both of you, either of you, could say a few words about how we harness that enthusiasm for activity rather than focus necessarily on the negativity around our trends. Second subject was I had some really interesting feedback today from a resident, Champion Hill Ward, which was the road that was made one way in my ward upset them. The LTNs to the south of the borough upset them. The ULEZ upset them. But they have now sold their car and bought an electric bike, and they're absolutely loving it. They did say it's hard, though, because it's a lot of stick and not much carrot. Is there anything more we could be considering at the carrot side? Obviously, I understand within that we are massively constrained in terms of funding. And my last one, because I've just read with him, well, there is loads of stuff I could talk about in your paper because there's just so much in it, which I think is really, really interesting. Something that I know we've talked about in the past is freight. And I'm just wondering if there's anything more you could say which you would advise the next administration to do as a priority looking at freight specifically. Thank you.
Do you want me to come back on the first question first?
Yeah, I
think it comes back to points around consultation and understanding what the issue is that you're trying to resolve locally in the context. I think there's an issue around no traffic intervention is in isolation because all roads lead to somewhere else. I think there's often a strategic message and understanding around traffic patterns and that combination of, if you like, local journeys and circular driving in around an area and through traffic and understanding the interplay. And then the third aspect is sustaining the local economy and the thriving sort of high street and that sort of local amenity and how all of those things are competing interests in terms of things you want to sort of proportionately support and encourage and enable versus the things you want to deter and prevent going forward. And I think what people have recognised is that when you envisage a street or a road that has an allocation of space that is not solely for the provision of cars, it changes the dynamic of the space. And you can do that visually through planting and interventions and filters, and you create a different environment altogether at the point of your front door, which I think is really appealing in terms of a principle and important. So when you get to that point of, again, enabling people to envisage their roads and streets in a different way, that's important, and we have to sort of manage that transition for people. And for different roads and streets, it will be to different degrees and different effects and impacts alongside the services, shops and local economy that they sit and live amongst going forward. But that's the potential, isn't it, if we do the process constructively and we're really clear about benefits over and above the air quality and improved environment and other challenges that we face for the planet. And that alternative choice around short journeys and then improving access when you need to make a longer journey by public transport, and that's more appealing full stop. So I think it touches on that, and if that's the carrot bit, isn't it? I think there's things we can do to incentivise decisions you make around a future vehicle, or what type of car that might be, and where you might want to expect to store that vehicle, and how you get a fuel source for that vehicle of whatever sort. And I think explaining to people what interventions are done proportionately and sensitively, reflecting local needs, can do are really appealing. And that's beneficial to all age ranges, and we should sort of communicate that really effectively. So I think that would be the general point around the notion of envy. I think everyone wants to have, you know, less through traffic, cleaner streets, greener streets, safer areas to walk and to cycle. And I think it's work on balance when we come up against criticism and resistance to strategic changes we make to create a strategic network so people can travel the full length of the borough. That we recognise that sometimes, you know, you have to do that for it in order to benefit everyone. And so suspending a network you're trying to build because car ownership levels difficult for a certain amount in that location isn't really a long-term solution for everyone overall. And it's worth remembering that the 10 schemes that we've done interventions on, there are filters on those roads, but every home and business is accessible by a car still, although alternative routes and through traffic has been prevented, that has been maintained, and that it's less than 4% of the total road network with those reprioritisations for something other than solely a car. So that's the conversation we need to have around people walking, cycling, and children in particular scooting, and adults using e-scooters. So I think that's the way to try and frame and harness that appetite for improvement, being sensitive to where the particular location. So that's on that one. What's the other point you made about? That's all right.
Jealousy.
No.
Freight
wasn't it?
Which I don't know.
Shall I leap in briefly?
Please do.
Okay. Might not be that brief. Okay. So I think the danger is that what we seem to be veering towards is LTNs as the only solution, which I think is a slightly dangerous territory to get into simply because. There are quite significant effects of large network effects of traffic displacement. And so it's all very nice if you live on a filtered road, but if you live on a road like Croxton Road, which Margie brought up right at the beginning, I think quite rightly, which has seen quite significant increases in congestion and pollution for longer hours during the day, with all the negative health impacts that will engender. Obviously, that's possibly not a great solution in that area. And actually, the problem is that if you look at somewhere, I'm just taking Dulwich as an example because I know it quite well, but it's slightly tricky because it doesn't have great public transport. It has extremely high, I think the highest car ownership in the borough. There's a kind of term time traffic generating industry in the form of highly prestigious and large catchment unlimited schools, and people are driving there partly because the public transport is bad, and then it's surrounded by hills, so it's an extremely difficult place to kind of centre, you know, a great big cycling area. So the question for me is that given that each LTN will have different impacts and different effects and will, according to its fundamentals, have a different chance of success, we need to look at things that will actually bring down car ownership and use. And the fact is that Southwark is about to fail to meet its targets for car ownership reduction in the borough. We have LIP targets, Catherine mentioned them earlier, we're not going to make them. And so unless we have a sort of holistic strategy that is predicated on actually tackling car ownership, which is the greatest predictor of car use, we really, really risk being in a situation where essentially we're just kind of pushing traffic and pollution around, and we're not dealing with the substantive problem. So, you know, one thing that I know we've spoken about before is the enormous amount of public realm that is taken up by parking. And to my mind, one of the most important things that we can do is not just consider things like CPZs, but actually go much further than that and think about a community curbside zone rather than a community parking zone. So you can talk to residents about what they want to see on their street. You know, maybe there's a situation where we kind of have a quid pro quo where residents will say, okay, look, we want a filtered street, but we're willing to phase out our parking, our on-street parking as we go. Because the cities that have made the biggest impact in terms of, you know, pollution, active travel and so on, are actually tackling parking as a major, major issue. You look at Paris, they've just designated an inner city zone which will essentially be car-free. There are some wrinkles there because they're still allowing residents, access to that bit of the city. But unless we actually grapple with the fact that essentially so much of the public realm is dominated by car storage and cars that are just simply not used for, you know, 99% of the day, we're not going to get to grips with this issue in a sort of serious way. And, you know, maybe the calculation is that, well, the displacement routes that are experiencing high traffic volumes, which mean greater harm, greater KSIs, more mentally unwell people, physically unwell people are collateral damage. That doesn't seem to be a very satisfactory way to be, and we have to think of a much, much more holistic solution that recognises that this is actually a complex problem. But we cannot do this accepting current levels of car ownership and car use, because it's just sort of tinkering around at the margins. And I would urge the next administration, the next committee, to really grapple with this. Sarah told us a lovely anecdote about one of her constituents' experiences of an LTN. I will tell you another, who said, it's really great to have an LTN because I can park my car more easily and, it's just great. So some people want an LTN because it enhances the car owning and car driving experience. Other people want them for other reasons, because they are genuinely switching modes and making everything healthier and happier. But, you know, there's a lot of anecdata here, and we just need to deal with the substantive issue, which is a landscape dominated by cars, dominated by use. And, it seems crazy to me that we close roads where people have 2, 3, 4 cars.
Okay, well, that's plenty of food for thought.
Yes, it did.
Catherine, you going to come back on the other 2 points that Sarah had raised, or had we dealt with those? I can't remember now.
I feel like we dealt with two of them, but like
the freight. The freight, that was it. I knew there was something.
Yeah, so again, the movement plan sets out what we've retrieved in working with partners on the freight Team London Bridge and offering those alternatives. So there's the, if you like, the ability to facilitate zero carbon delivery mechanisms to companies. There's work we're doing around larger sort of hubs where larger vehicles can bring freight into the borough, and then it'd be distributed in smaller zero-emission vehicles. The development piece around that, and putting the infrastructure in place when we create new uses for land and development to ensure that that's built in. And that's happening along Old Kent Road and Canada Water, and then that more sort of organic sort of demand-led responding to companies and local traders and businesses that want to explore and encourage that. So we offer and incentivise schemes to allow businesses to be trained and to purchase and to lease and to hire cargo bikes and forms of alternative freight distribution and deliveries. But there's a lot more work that we can do on that, and that's where the next focus will be, on sustaining that. So it's the macro big sort of freight importers, if you like, or through traffic in relation to freight, and then the distribution of freight goods and logistics to our residents and companies within the borough. So we're looking at all of that in the round as well.
Lovely. Yes, please. Rather come in. Yeah.
Sorry, thank you. Thank you for asking the question on freight, Sarah. You know, it's very close to my heart. As you know, there are good things going on, particularly up near the river with the Better Bankside project. DHL is doing some interesting river freight work with small micro distribution hubs and delivery by cargo bike, which is very encouraging. There are some good grassroots groups like Plastic Free Peckham that have a sustainable Southwark project, and I know that they're talking to officers now about a project to really try and help make the high street sustainable in terms of delivery, but also really reducing single-use plastics and so on. So, you know, I'm sure there are these little kind of pockets of activity, and I know that the Bellenden Road shops are one focus of Plastic Free Peckham's activity, but if that can be expanded out into much bigger high streets like Lordship Lane, all the shops on Dulwich Village, or if we can help coordinate, Jack has spoken about this before actually, specific delivery times, you know, that will all help, I think, in that big piece of the jigsaw. The other thing I would add is that, you know, Catherine's spoken a lot about communications and engagement, and I know my a very dear ward colleague, Jason Ottery, has done some really good work with businesses, but I think it's fair to say that because everything was done at scale and pace with a lot of the LTNs, perhaps the business piece wasn't looked at sufficiently right in the beginning, and I know he and Catherine have been doing some work to help that, but obviously engaging the business community is absolutely critical, because what we don't want to happen is them to feel disenfranchised from the conversation and also to simply feel as though their business is being impacted and that they you know, it's having an impact on their livelihood. So I think the business piece needs to be woven in far more. We always think about our residents because that's our duty, but you know, businesses are lifeblood in many ways, and need to be a part of the conversation in a strategic way, and not as a kind of slight afterthought. No criticism of colleagues or officers or anyone. It's just how it played out. It was a very difficult time, and we were doing things very quickly, but you know, the next administration, I'm sure, will grapple with business right up front.
Yes, and many of our businesses are residents at the same time.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Sarah.
Sorry, Chair, I've got two separate follow-ups very quickly, which won't be very quick, I know. So it's really interesting to hear both of you talk about freight. It would be... I'm conscious, Neve, if you talked about the, in what I can't think of a generic word to use, but the Amazon delivery vehicle across the borough, and we're living in a society at the moment where there was an absolute explosion in terms of having things delivered to our homes. They tend to come in vans that are unidentifiable to us. There was once a statistic that 1 in 7 HGVs was actually owned by Tesco's, but they didn't put it on the side of the HGV because they knew it was bad for business. I wonder how many Amazon vans there are in our borough at any one time, which are at the lower end, that they may be ULEZ compliant, but are probably at the lower end of performance. I know some people in this committee don't like to see us campaign for things, but I do think we need a London-wide response to the electrification of delivery vehicles, and it would be great to see us as an administration leading the way on that, and also making sure the planning policy is there to allow that to be a real thing. I think that was a follow-up question. And then my second one was just to come back to LTN jealousy, because I think maybe I could be clearer. I'm not sure LTN jealousy means someone wants an LTN, if that makes sense. I think there are residents that I know well who'd like some pavements to be widened, but it is explained on the doorstep in context of seeing investment go to other areas. So to make the question a bit more specific, do we have the money in the right place to allow our residents to come forward with schemes that may currently be funded by default highway budgets, but it's difficult to deliver all of them given the constraints on that funding? Is there any other funding, and are there other ways to look at funding to help our residents deliver their aspirations for their communities, which reduces traffic movements and makes our communities safer? Thank you.
Well, the short answer to that, we've come up with a balanced budget for the next year. I've set out the context in terms of TfL funding. The movement plan details and summarises a position statement in terms of the highways revenue and demands and expenditure. I'm always looking to ensure that by law, with that reinvestment into our road infrastructure and highways and ancillary uses is set out. And I think once we get some clarification or some certainty around TfL funding, and we can look at ways in which we can work with ward councillors, devolved highways, cleaner, green, safer funding, and the central sort of capital investment programme, to make sure that we can develop those plans, those list of priorities, those things that clearly set out what we can do and when we can achieve it, be it the aspiration around station approaches, be it an aspiration around infrastructure support, Amazon lockers and routes to them, better stuff, more cycle storage at key points, or pavement widening. So I think that's the challenge for us going forward, better, smarter use of constrained resources, but having that clear sort of framework and plan that's known and understood by people in within a ward level, to know what that means in context for them, and how also the wider strategic road network and the wider strategic objectives we have are served by that work, and they know and understand and appreciate it. And we appreciate them in return.
Can I briefly step in? Sarah, I completely agree about your electrification stuff. I think it's wonderful. We need better infrastructure. We need delivery vans being zero emissions, and any soft power that we have to influence that should be, or even hard power, should be deployed. In many ways, the sort of the traditional understanding of an LTN is sort of slightly yesterday's solution, only in the sense that it was thought about in without a world full of delivery vehicles, as you've just illustrated, and also without private hire vehicles really dominating London. It's very much a London kind of problem. So again, I'm sort of, as ever, calling for perhaps a different solution, more holistic solution there. I've actually just forgotten the excellent point I was going to make. LTN jealousy. So So the thing is, I liked your modified definition of it, which was very useful. I think the other thing is, I said earlier on that modal filters and close roads and all that kind of thing have quite large network effects, and we should be much better at modelling the likely effects so that I think we can let communities know what those effects are likely to be. So I'm slightly worried by an idea of certain sections of the community advocating for, you know, whether it's a closed road or something else, because the problem is that you can get to a situation where you have people with only the people with sufficient social capital, and sometimes that aligns with actual capital, asking for interventions that work in their favour. And I think one of the, you know, so we have to kind of guard against that, and obviously you've seen my paper, which is very much focused on, you know, making sure that these things really do work for everyone, and that there's a robust kind of equalities approach to things. And so, you know, I'd be slightly worried about, I love devolution, but devolving a great deal of power, you know, outside a kind of proper, robust, strategic equalities framework could be quite difficult. I mean, Sarah, you're my ward councillor. You know, there's a school in my ward where, for example, it's very, very difficult to get to the parents, to get the school involved, etc. And we know why that is. It's that people are working, you know, night shifts, three jobs, etc., etc. So I'd always call for a proper framework for involving communities and making sure interventions are thought of in the widest context. And one of the nicest things, actually, about the, someone talked about the Dulwich consultation earlier on, but lots of people, in a funny way, what was nice to see was there were so many people who technically had an advantage from the changes, but who were so worried about their neighbours and their friends, and who essentially didn't want to benefit at their expense. So, you know, I think there is quite strong community feeling all over the borough, and we do have to make sure there isn't too much of an asymmetry of harms and benefits when we deliver schemes like this.
Okay. Was there anything else outstanding? No? Okay. If there's no further questions, I'd like to thank... Oh! It's always the one at the end, isn't it? So
I
can't see that far away.
Yeah.
It's I've got a blind spot, I'm afraid, for that chair. Councillor Bavoudou.
Well, I kind of ended up on quite a basic question that I think you may have already answered, but I wanted to kind of ask it afresh just to be sure I'm right on the response. And although it's kind of driven by Councillor Burgess's paper, I think it's somewhat both. And it was just, I looked at the kind of goals we were setting out, and I thought the kind of improved health and wellbeing for a kind of fantastic one. Just what do we know about the kind of differential impact from a qualities perspective from our kind of early work thus far? And then the second point, I thought I took from what Roger was saying that even in summary, we can't
Can I just say, I only heard, I think, the first half of that question, and that was, do we have a sense of the equalities impact? Was that right?
Yeah, I mean, to over-summarise it, it was like...
Just speak into the microphone a bit more, please.
If you insist, Chair.
I do.
That was the first part, and the second part was just in terms of some of our early view on the outcomes. I took from what you were saying, rather, that the short answer is, oh, we don't quite know just yet. But I just wondered if there are like kind of high level takeaways that you could just in summary kind of say at this stage.
Catherine probably has more details than me, but certainly there was an attempt, I think, early on to really get quite granular in terms of officers came up with a suggestion that really drilled down into trying to understand the makeup of the demographics of the people who are affected on, I think, certain roads, and maybe it was too in-depth a piece of work and would have taken too much resource, but it was interesting because, you know, there was a proposal to look at household income and housing tenure and employment status, you know, so really kind of getting into the weeds of all of that stuff that you find on, you know, consumer bucketing websites like Mosaic or Experian. And so I think that was probably a resource issue at the time, but it's certainly a piece of work that should be done because we should understand in a kind of objective a way as possible who's winning and who's losing, because there are winners and losers, and see how that pans out from an equalities perspective. We do have some equalities impacts assessments that were conducted I can't remember what they were called, but anyway, we had a firm do those equality impact assessments, and people were asked their ethnicity, they were asked their sex, and all sorts of other things. And I think the feedback was that there was quite firm resistance, I think, from BAME communities, the elderly, and I think there's one page in the report. This is only the Dulwich scheme. I think I can't speak to the Waller scheme or anything else. But definitely the feedback from certain protected groups was not that positive. So I think that, you know, and I think in the report it does say that, you know, further work needs to be done on that. And obviously the whole paper is about advocating for that work to be done as a matter of course. And, you know, it's hugely important because we do want to get this right for everyone. We do want to make sure that everybody benefits and that you're not, you know, protected groups aren't negatively and disproportionately impacted. So that's my answer. What, have I answered it, Peter? I've gotten the second bit of your question. Certainly, Catherine has all the detail on what the feedback was from the survey, but we could do a lot more work, I think, at the beginning, really, to try and make sure that we're really teasing out that information so we have a very good sense of what's going on. And again, it just comes back to giving the public confidence that we're doing the right thing, and, you know, so that they can be happy with what we're doing on their behalf.
Okay. Is there anything else, Peter?
That's great. That's great from the quality side. So it was just also the on kind of
Just to be absolutely sort of clear in terms of the due process that all the schemes have gone through, there's variation between the schemes, and Peter spoke about the overall objectives that we set out in the framework for the interventions, and they are numerous in the sense of they range from safer walking and cycling through to improved air quality through to that modal shift point and allowing local high streets to thrive, and they're set out in, clearly. What is also apparent that obviously because we've talked about location, locality and position in the ward, that all those schemes are not homogeneous and identical, and they deliver outcomes and benefits against all those objectives and goals to varying and different degrees. So I think often we're criticised that we haven't, or we're accused of not delivering an equal amount of improvement across all of those 9 goals universally the same, and therefore the scheme is in some way limited or failed, or can be criticised. And I think that doesn't actually reflect the sort of the purpose. So those are objectives that are borough-wide and holistic in that sense, but the individual schemes will have priorities and a focus within those priorities to which that scheme speaks to most directly and has a more direct outcome and influence, and how all those schemes together with everything else we're doing in relation to traffic and transport contributes to the sum total. So we have spent a lot of time this evening talking about LTNs again in a consuming way, but again, if I refer you to the movement plan update, you will see that in its wider context and everything else that we have achieved over the past 2 years, and how this street space programme is there allowed providing more information, data and understanding in the particular context of the pandemic and the way it was introduced that will help strengthen and embolden all forms of traffic intervention going forward. So again, we should move away from this notion that if LTNs or nothing, and also this notion that that you can take a position on it that is valid in all circumstances going forward. That's simply not reflective of reality either way. Each of the schemes has had an EQIA assessment done. We specifically worked with Guy's and St Thomas's Trust, and they worked with Clearview, and they did independent in-depth sampling to the schemes around Camberwell, North Peckham, I think it's East Faraday area, that made up their grouping of schemes, and the goals and objectives were supplemented by what Guidance and Thomas's Trust wanted to look at in terms of outcomes, and that the learning from that is really particular and valuable not only to them but to us as a borough. And there was detailed engagement with groups of protected characteristics, and there was their challenge around the messaging and the communication has been really informative going forward, and how we communicate these things, which is another key learning point. The Walworth EQIA is really comprehensive because it's set in the context of the low emissions network that predated streetscape schemes and interventions. That's a really good and valid document. The Dulwich work and Walworth was supplemented by sampling by our own consultation team, where we got those groups together, and we were the people who had responded to the survey were invited to come in and talk specifically about those issues. And the whole point of that was to engage and to draw out from those groups that challenge to it in order to understand what the issues were, and that is going to help inform and shape how we communicate about interventions, not only to those communities but everyone else. And then the work on Rye Lane and the opportunity we get from the learnings of the previous schemes to sort of help shape and inform the discussions around the trial and the intervention that we've got going there, and how that leads on to a much wider conversation about wellbeing and the context around Rye Lane and the community. So I'll just make those points. I don't think there's been as much work done on traffic interventions anywhere else to this extent, so I think it's a valuable resource and something that we build on rather than a negative. But the fair challenge is there and it's documented, and that's what we're seeking to work through It's important that work has been done for the first time, working with groups like All Choked Up and Transport for All and the Way, and other advocacy groups such as Moms for Lungs and Southwark Pensioners and all those groups that now have traffic, transport and amenity for and quality of life framed in that way, in a way that didn't exist before the pandemic. It's really important.
Okay, I think we've come to an end now. I'd like to say thank you to both Councillor Catherine Rose and to Councillor Roger Burgess. Thank you for giving such a... We've been here for over 2 hours, somehow I knew we would be. Thank you once again for your fulsome responses to members' questions, which is greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the committee.
Thank you.
Bye.
And good night.
Yeah, thank you for being here in person as well.
And
I
hope I've been enough on
the
three
points, but Tara will come back with any questions
that
you've got. I'm just
going to
thank both her and
Dale
for participating this evening.
Great. Thank you. I think perhaps we should take a 5-minute break, because we've been at it for over 2 hours, as I say, and then we'll come back and finish off the rest of the agenda. Won't take too long, I don't think. Thank you very much.